This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It's Monday, April 1st, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. In geopolitical news, seven officers, including three generals in Iran's Quds Force, were killed in an attack in a building in Damascus. Both the Iranians and the Israelis are confirming that it was an Israeli missile that carried out the attack. What can I tell you other than that this Quds Force, a wider war in the region? Everyone knows this. Let us hope Hezbollah, Iran's proxy, does not act on it. That is the news. It will develop. Let's turn to sports, because over the weekend, it was some excellent NCAA basketball action. There will be some excellent, I presume, NCAA basketball action as LSU and Iowa rematch tonight. We will see Caitlin Clark take on Kim Mulkey and her Louisiana State Tigers. You know that women's college basketball will have achieved true parity with the men, not based on TV ratings, but when the LSU Lady Tigers can just be called the Tigers, or when we will stop referring to the team from Rhode Island as the University of Rhode Island Lady Rams. Perhaps we will refer to the men's team as the Male Hughes. Couple weird stories, though, in the women's tournament. There was a referee crew. This was about a week ago. That included a referee named Tommy Paris. And halfway into the game, literally at halftime, someone looked up Tommy Paris's LinkedIn page. They found out he got a master's degree in public administration from Chattanooga. Chattanooga was involved in the game. They took Tommy Paris off the game. No Chattanoogan grad can possibly faithfully referee a game. That was kind of silly because it was a blowout. Tommy Paris's skills were not in any way impinged, but you know who was impinged, greatly impinged? Hanna Hidalgo, who had her nose ring removed or forcibly removed by trainers from the Notre Dame staff after all season playing with the nose ring, after one of the referees in the game said, yeah, of course you can play with the nose ring. But then another referee in her game against Oregon State noticed the nose ring and says, it's got to come out. What's an athletic trainer know about removing a nose ring? So you have this vision of people with like pliers standing over the excellent All-American basketball player. For 4 minutes, she couldn't go in the game. She was on a hot streak. Notre Dame wound up losing. They did remove the nose ring. Then there was this crazy story. I'll read the statement from the NCAA. The quote, the NCAA was notified today that the three-point lines on the court at the Moda Center in Portland were not the same distances. The two head coaches were made aware of the discrepancy and elected to play a complete game on the court as is, rather than correcting the court and delaying the game. Okay, but the Moda Center in Portland had been the site of several previous games, and no one noticed it. But if you look at the shooting percentages, teams were terrible from the mismatch side of the court. The NCAA court drawers, they say it's a big deal. It's the first time they could use the word March Madness. The NCAA wants us to know that the women's game is back. They don't even draw the court correctly. Kind of crazy. And then we get to Kim Mulkey, the highest paid coach in the game. And she Streisand affected a story that was coming out about her. You know this phrase, Streisand effect. It's when Barbara Streisand sued a photographer so no one would know about her house or the position of her house on the California coast. But the lawsuit brought more attention than anyone or any photographer would have anyway. So the Streisand effect is when you draw attention to something by complaining about it beforehand. That's what Kim Mulkey did to this story about her in the Washington Post. Although Kim Mulkey is pretty savvy. Maybe she wanted attention paid to her too. I don't know, take it off her student athletes. I'm glad I read the story. I'm not sure I would have anyway. And there were no bombshells. We always knew that Kim Mulkey was a very difficult person, a very driven person, not particularly LGBTQIA friendly, plus, not even the plus. But the writing was great. You talk about her father, Les, and her sister. And Kim and her sister are estranged, but her sister believes that maybe someday we'll get back together and have a relationship with my difficult sibling. As for her father, I'll quote the story. Les has no such delusions. Isn't it odd, he says, to love a child so much that you leave them be? It's how Kim wants it, he says, but he prays every night that tomorrow she will want something new. He is 86 now and lives alone in a dilapidated trailer way out past the pines. The pines! They always live past the pines. That always gets me. They never live within the pines or just this side of the pines. They live out past the pines. It's where he retreats after his drives to Baton Rouge. He has dozens of pictures, newspaper cutouts, mementos from Kim's basketball career. Tammy, that's Kim's sister, calls it a shrine. It's all he has left of her. And with many of Les's friends dying recently, he thinks about what's next. He was cocky, he says, stubborn, a little too proud, he says. So when his time comes, Les figures it will be when he's alone, surrounded by achievements but not people, wasting away like the things he once built. You know what? That's not liable. That's not actionable. I don't know if I got Streisand affected into it, but I got some goosebumps. Kim Mulkey creates great basketball teams and drama all around her, wherever she goes. On the show today, it is April Fool's Day. Let's play a game, all right? Spot the fake Rolex. But first, Jim Sciutto is a news anchor and has been the chief national security correspondent for CNN since 2013. He is also a veteran of the Obama administration, working for a time with them, drawing on his expertise on foreign relations to make the government work a bit better. He is also, and has been on the show before, to talk about his area of expertise. His new book is called The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. In part one of this interview, we shall discuss NATO. Jim Sciutto up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You might think of Jim Sciutto as the well-coiffed CNN newsman. I mean, comparatively, well-coiffed compared to me, but I like to think of him as bobbing along in the Baltic Sea on a rigid inflatable boat trying to transfer from one frigate to another. Just a radical version of Outward Bound and what he does on vacation. No, it's part of his reporting for the new book, The Return of Great Powers, Russia, China, and the Next World War. Jim is not just a CNN anchor and a trusted newsman, but a veteran of the State Department and that network's expert on intelligence and diplomacy. Jim, welcome back to The Gist.
So good to be back. Thanks so much, man.
What found you on that frigate or those frigates?
So, listen, I was trying for this book, and I always do this when I write, I want to go to where it's happening, right? I want to go to the front lines. I want to go to Ukraine, Taiwan, the Baltic. I don't want to hear about it from Washington. I want to go see it for myself. And in addition to being in Ukraine and Taiwan for the book, you know, fronts in this standoff between U.S., Russia, and China, the Baltic is key because this is where NATO is expanding. And therefore, and this in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it's also where we're extending this dividing line between East and West, between NATO and Russia. And so I asked to go on one of these patrols up there that NATO is doing, and they've done them for years, but now they're bigger, they're more frequent, the number of ships, about twice as many ships taking part. And when these NATO joint task forces are operating there, they take it seriously. It's not, and I, you know, I'd ask the sailors, I'd ask the commanders, is this a practice for you? Is it rehearsal? Is it just sort of light training? They said, no, we see the threat very differently now. So I went on it was a German frigate that was commanding this, but there were half a dozen nations represented. There were French, there were Dutch, there were Spanish, there were Portuguese. And that's another message that, listen, you can argue pretty decently that Europe dragged its feet on standing up to Russia in terms of, you know, getting their militaries in order and that kind of thing. But they are taking it seriously now. And that's why I ended up on that ship.
Well, let's talk NATO and let's talk a country that you spent a lot of time in, Estonia. There, I'm fascinated by Estonia. I love Estonia. There you talk to the current Prime Minister, Kaja Kallas, and she talked to you about the tripwire philosophy, which I'd like you to explain, and then we'll get into some of the implications, which is that, after you explained it to the listeners, they might be surprised to know that the rest of NATO didn't even know that there was a tripwire in place. But go ahead, tell us about the tripwire.
Listen, first, like you, I love the Estonians. I just got to tell you, here's a tiny little country, less than a couple million people. They're right on the border with Russia. They only got their independence from the Soviet Union in 1991. So their memory of being under the yoke of the Kremlin is recent.
Yes.
It's one generation away.
And they're the most successful of all the former Soviet republics. And if you go there, they have all your information on the blockchain. So going to the doctor is a joy. It's a really fascinating, successful country that I want to thrive. And part of that depends on Russia staying away. But go ahead.
Exactly. 100%. They vote online securely. You know, they're way ahead of us in so many ways. But they have that recent experience. And they are right on the border, and they fear that if Ukraine were to fall, they would be Russia's next target. And by the way, that's not unfounded. If you listen to Putin and Medvedev and others, they don't respect the Baltic's independence. So NATO's defense plan, knowing this, until very recently was, it's known as tripwire. In effect, Russian forces come across the border. They very quickly take over the country because Estonia is tiny. And then NATO forces go in, and the plan is within 180 days, half a year, they take it back. Now, for the Estonians, particularly as they watch Russia run roughshod over Ukraine, burning cities down, raping literally, and pillaging, they say, that's not good enough for us because we see what Russia could do in 6 months. There would be nothing left of us. You need a better plan. You need to stop them before they come in.
Yes.
And
the canary in the coal, the canary in the coal mine is an inexact strategy, but it's especially horrible for the canaries themselves.
100%. Basically, you kill the canary. I mean, that's what they say. So when Kallas is telling me this story, she says when she complained about this plan post-Ukraine invasion to her fellow prime ministers in NATO, and she said, this can't work. They said, wait, that's our plan for defending you? We didn't know that. And when she spoke about it publicly in Estonia, the Estonian public said, wait a second, that's NATO's plan for us? They didn't know either. So on the good side, she has gotten them, and NATO has seen the light to some degree to say, we actually have to intervene earlier. And they have some pre-positioned forces and weapons, and they have a quick reaction force, in effect, that would get there, she says, within hours of a Russian invasion. So the plan is better now, but it gives you a sense of how seriously, particularly the Eastern-facing allies, take the threat from Russia.
Right. So this brings up some problems with NATO, which I want NATO to succeed. And I think it's a necessary, well, tying together of diplomatic missions of different countries and a necessary bulwark to aggression, all those things. But it is also a collection of democracies, and democracies change their leaders, whereas Vladimir Putin has and will continue to be in power for a long time. Does that fact alone, that it constantly change, and not just institutional memory, but different democratically elected politicians, especially the United States democratically elected presidents, might have entirely different concepts of NATO? How much does that harm or threaten the coherence of NATO?
100%. You know, we're getting used to, maybe we're not getting used to it, but we've come to recognize this pendulum swing between the parties in our own country on a whole host of issues, whether it's abortion rights, economic policy, tax policy, you name it. What's new is that what had been consistent bipartisan foreign policy is now on that same pendulum. So you swing from Biden, much more traditional approach. We value our alliances. We will stand by our defense commitments to NATO allies, to allies in Asia. And we believe that Russia, China, North Korea don't have our best interests at heart, right? That we have to stand up to them. We don't like what they're doing. To a Trump America First approach, which would turn that on its head. It wouldn't be a slight course correction. And I have a whole chapter on this because I speak to many senior former advisors of Trump. It would be a 180 degree turn. That they believe he would take the U.S. out of NATO, or at least neuter that defense commitment. They think he would do the same with defense commitments to South Korea and Japan. And they also believe, and listen, you and I hear what Trump says, and we see how he speaks about Putin and Xi and so on. They believe that he would seek an accommodation with them, and that part of that accommodation would include giving up some of those sovereign nations caught in the middle, like a Ukraine, like a Taiwan.
Yeah. Yeah. And the book is about great powers, and the three great powers, China, Russia, and the U.S. Putin's been in power in one form or another since 1999. Xi did get an unprecedented third term as chairman of the Communist Party, and I suppose he has internal politics to navigate, but he's there for the long time, never mind the whole idea of China thinking in terms of eons or dynasties and not years. And then you have the United States, which more or less, as you said, used to have, even if you change presidencies, more or less unified foreign policy. It doesn't. This is a consequence of the rise of populism. But just on those dimensions alone, and if there is a chessboard with the leaders of two, well, it's three-dimensional. So mm-hmm. If there is a go board with two of the leaders being there for the long haul and one constantly changing and having a great deal of variety when they change, mm-hmm. I'd put my money on the two rather than the one.
Yeah, and it's something that our own allies worry about, right? They worry about this pendulum, which raises questions, reasonable questions, about the seriousness of America's commitments to alliances. If one president says, we are in it, we respect Article 5, we will come to defend our allies in Eastern Europe if they were attacked by Russia, and the next guy says, I'm not so sure. Russia, do whatever the hell you want, right, if, say, those allies don't pay their due. You know, that weakens the alliance across the board, because then those leaders might calculate, given, as you say, they don't have term limits, I'll just wait for the next guy, and I'll get a more friendly treatment. And it's not you and I just making that up, right? I mean, Trump has said as much, and his own former advisors say this is what he'll do.
Yes. It seems that the only, from your reporting and quoting on the record, people in the room and former top advisors, you know, Bolton among them. The only reason why Donald Trump didn't pursue disengaging with NATO was his heart wasn't in it that much. Yeah. That was his inclination. I don't just mean disengaging, but, you know, flat out withdrawal. He would get into fits of pique and the quote unquote adults in the room would draw him back. And it just that it didn't light his fire as much as some of his other causes.
No question.
That's the impression at least I got.
Well, John Kelly, you know, who was his chief of staff, says as much. He said that he would get in these fits, and that his best strategy was, and I've heard this from other advisors on other key national security decisions, their best strategy to keep him from the worst decisions was just get him to forget about it, right? Get him to get over the 12 or 24 or 48 hour moment of pique so that he just moves on. I mean, Kelly says as much. I mean, he says, you know, excuse the language, but he's like, we just wanted to get him to say, well, fuck it. Okay, I'm not going to do that right now and hope he doesn't think about it for a while.
Give
and
him
that
a wall to throw some ketchup against.
Basically. And that is, again, you know, this is not you or me making it up. As you say, I quote folks who were in the room with him for years on some of the most consequential decisions as commander in chief, and they recount in detail this is how he makes decisions in the moment. And this is how they kept him from some of the worst decisions.
If Kelly is going on the record, and to me that's very important and often overlooked in journalism, if he's going on the record and putting his name to that, it's important to him. It's important to him that the public knows that this is a threat or a possibility that's looming out there. Now, let's think about Trump, who very well could be elected president again. You know, when he complains about NATO members not paying their dues, which is essentially he means the 2% of GDP commitment, he's not wrong. And even though NATO members are paying more of their dues, it's because Russia rolled into Ukraine. So that certainly clarifies the mind. But even Kallas of Estonia talked about before Article 5, there's Article 3, and that says everybody has to make everything possible to defend themselves. And she gave you the example of Germany, which did eventually give some tanks to Ukraine, and then in its own arsenal, gave away 14 tanks, only replaced them with 12. So here's a question that we Westerners didn't think we'd ask for the last 100 years, but why are the Germans so peaceful or so anti-militaristic?
Well, they're not alone, right? Because there are other European allies, and it's a fair criticism, who did not, you know, pay their way, so to speak, or do their fair share of building up militaries to meet NATO's defensive mission, right? I mean, its mission is to protect Europe from Russian aggression. That's in its charter. That's a fair criticism. The thing is, Trump puts it as a quid pro quo to say that if you don't meet what is a goal of 2% GDP going to defense, then we will not honor the decades-old mutual defense agreement, right? You know, when 9/11 happened and NATO invoked Article 5 for the first time in its history, mutual defense, and NATO countries went to the U.S., went to war with the U.S. in Afghanistan, they did not ask, what are you paying on defense, or what are you going to give us? They invoked it, and they went, and their men and women died on the battlefield alongside the U.S. in Afghanistan, right? So what Trump is doing is saying, I'm not going to defend you unless you meet this target, which is aspirational. It's not part of the treaty commitment. It's a very reasonable one, but it's not a quid pro quo, and that's the difference. And the thing about alliances and deterrence, right, is that it's only as good as it is credible. And if you have a president who is saying, I may not honor it, then both allies and adversaries calculate that he may very well not honor it. And the thing is, with Trump, it's not just tied to the money issue, because he has made the case publicly that, well, maybe we can deal with Russia on Ukraine. And his own advisors have said, well, maybe Ukraine has to give up some territory. Speaking of Taiwan, I have John Bolton in the book telling a story about how Trump spoke about Taiwan. Trump would hold up a Sharpie at the desk in the Oval Office and say, see the tip of this Sharpie? That's Taiwan. See this desk? That's China. Point being, it's got no chance, and therefore we have no business defending it. So if that's the president's view, then, you know, then what is the actual deterrence there? Because China will say, that guy's not going to defend Taiwan. Door's open.
Yeah. That's so Trump, the vivid imagery. He's great at that. Mm-hmm. Plus the use of the Sharpie, maybe to redirect hurricanes. Okay, yeah. You don't have to comment on that. I said that. But I did ask about Germany. I'm going to get back to Trump and his psychology in a second. What is your assessment of why the Germans are less than satisfying their commitment? So to lay it out, if you look at the chart of which countries are satisfying the 2% GDP commitment, the United States always does. And for some reason, Greece always does. But in general, there's a correlation between geographic proximity to Russia in recent years and actually hitting the 2%. I can think of maybe four reasons why Germany would drag their feet. One, they're so war scarred that the Green Party is ascendant, and there is a much greater peace movement in Germany than in other countries. That's true. Two, the free rider problem. If someone's going to do it, it's in everyone's interest to let those other people do it. Three, they are geographically removed and energy dependent on Germany. And four, I think there are some elements in the German public, former prime ministers, that actually have ties and maybe have been bought off a little bit by Russia. So what do you think?
So, listen, part of it is political, right? And I think it is true. Germany's history factors into this. It is loath to militarize and gird itself for the next war. And that politics extends. I spoke to soldiers, to sailors and commanders on that German frigate, and a lot of them were folks who entered the military back when Germany had required national military service. It doesn't anymore. And they complain about it. They say the young people today, they just have no interest in the military. And the military, you talk about a recruitment problem in the States, they have a recruitment problem in Germany. So it's
right. That's why that's one of the reasons why it's been overrun by all these right wingers and, you know, dangerous well, it wouldn't be nationalists, but dangerous, you know, racist affiliates. But go ahead.
Exactly. So I think partly it's political. It's about domestic population. I think some of it is geographical. It's not as close to the threat as Poland, the Baltics, because they're close up. They feel like they're next. So it's harder. It's easier for them to motivate their populations. But I also think that Germany under Merkel threw its lot in with engagement with Russia. That was its decades-long policy. To say that this is the best path forward, that we can work with them, we could find a way. Now, to their credit, they have totally reversed that. That's done. That policy is done, and Merkel's legacy is stained as a result. And by the way, on energy, they have also virtually ended their dependence on Russian energy, which is remarkable. If you think from our perspective, the price to Americans in energy terms of this war was gas was expensive for a few months. Like, Germany has had to find an entirely new supplier for its energy, and it started to do so within months. It takes a while to turn the ship of state, right? So they're turning it to some degree, but in some ways, you're absolutely right. They have not stepped up militarily, and I mean, you're even seeing that now with this debate over sending long-range missiles to Ukraine as well.
We'll finish our conversation with Jim Sciutto tomorrow when we discuss Donald Trump's views on NATO, Taiwan, and if the U.S. should have funded Ukraine during the beginning of the war. Join us for that. And now the spiel. April Fool's Rolex News. April Fool's News, where I try to fool you about which stories about Rolex watches are real and which is a source of an April Fool's prank from me to you. Try to spot the fake Rolex. Story one, internet sleuths, I love the plural of sleuth, have begun watching old videos of Ipe Mizuhara, Shohei Ohtani's interpreter. If you've been following the story, Mizuhara either received a loan or stole about $4.5 million from Ohtani to cover gambling debts. Now, Dodgers fans, gambling opponents, just curious contributors to the national dialogue have begun poring over old press conferences that the pitcher and interpreter gave side by side, they found that Ms. Uehara started sporting a Rolex at a time when Ohtani was struggling at the plate. Then they spotted different and more expensive Rolexes when Ohtani was shut down for the season as a pitcher. They theorized that Ms. Uehara's personal fortune seemed to coincide with Ohtani's travails, leading to a theory that the interpreter, based on inside knowledge, was profiting off his connection to the superstar. Story 2. A French-Canadian Rolex dealer was ripped off by a magician. The subject of the old okey-doke, or maybe it was the old switcheroo, or in French, because he was a French-Canadian Rolex dealer, that'd be the old commutator aru. Story 3. The president of Peru, speaking of Aru, is being investigated. Her house is being raided. Why? Just because she wore Rolex watches. There's no real greater theory or backdoor channel ideas or complex chart with red strings connecting people who bribed, gave bribes, engaged in graft. None of that. She wore some watches while giving a speech one day, and a few weeks later, bam, that is the sound of a battering ram outside the presidential palace. All right. We give you those stories. Spot the fake Rolex. Well, to help you along, we have some tape about some of the stories, and we didn't concoct this tape. Here are the real stories. So I don't know if you said that it was the Peruvian president, the French-Canadian Rolex dealer, or the Dodger interpreter, but we have tape of one of the stories that actually happened. Here now is the CBC reporting on the travails of Laurent Metel.
So this is how I prefer to deal. But unfortunately, this guy was a magician.
Yes, the CBC actually hired a magician to show you how the quote-unquote trick was pulled off. You did not need a magician. You just needed anyone with two envelopes of equal thickness. One has money, the other didn't. Switch them out. I have to say, the CBC magician was kind of a bad magician. All right, now we're down to two. Do you want to switch your answer? You should, according to the Monty Hall problem. But anyway, or just go by your intuition. You're down by two. One is the Ohtani interpreter. One is the president of Peru. Here now, in a foreign language for which I have no interpretation, is the real story.
Que la presidenta estaba buscando réplicas de los cuatro Rolex que han sido detectados hasta ahora para poder ofrecer esas réplicas como prueba.
I did a little switcheroo with you there, didn't I? Yes, that's Dina Boluarte. She was seen wearing watches. The watch was on. It was dubbed Rolex Gate. Of course it was. A couple weeks later, the police have come searching. She was also seen wearing a $5,000 bracelet, and an investigative media program found that she had about $300,000 American put in a bank account that she maintained between 2016 and 2022. I do not understand the significance of the bank account. She didn't hold public office until 2021. She was vice president, so she was a lawyer. She's not allowed to deposit $45,000 a year. The investigative report said she paid $28,000 cash for a truck in 2018. I don't know why that's wrong. Anyway, Truckgate isn't as good as Rolex Gate. But you know who's not corrupt in all of this? Shohei Ohtani's interpreter. Only he very likely is, just not in the specific Rolex sort of way. So if you said Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, Ippei Mizuhara, you spotted the fake Rolex. If not, then you, sir or madam, you are an April Fool, and this is a good day to be one because there's safety in numbers, especially if you're not handling cash transactions with Canadian magicians. And that's it for today's show. The Quaint Mallards are back. They're Corey Wara, producer, and Joel Patterson, senior producer. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for us here at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpuru, jeepuru, doopuru. Thanks for listening.